This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
He studied the minds of killers. He earned degrees in criminology, carried himself like a man who understood how to avoid getting caught. But Brian Koberger didn't just study crime, he became its architect. Today in A Haunting Twist, we're going to look back at the man who admitted to the brutal slaughter of four college students in Idaho. What was going on in his mind? Was he a ticking time bomb, hiding in plain sight, or a cold-blooded predator obsessed with power, control, and notoriety? Joining me is retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, who has been on this case from the very beginning. Together, we're going to start peeling back the layers now retrospectively as we sit with Brian Koberger making his admissions just the other week about Koberger's psychology from this new perspective, his obsessions, his ideology, his patterns, and asking the question everybody wants answered: what makes someone like this carry out a crime like this? Did he snap? Was this planned? And can we ever see it coming before it's too late? Jennifer, let's start with that, because I think at the end of the day, when we start looking at this case and really start breaking it down, and now he's admitted to it, do we study him? Can we study him? Is there anything to be learned from Brian Koberger about trying to spot the next Brian Koberger before it's too late?
Well, you know, Tony, serial killers and mass killers have been studied since the beginning of murdering, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's books and annals and psychologists who have spent their life's work on that. And I found it very interesting, and I have the utmost respect for Dr. Ramsland, mm-hmm. but very interesting that she was his teacher in four classes. Three undergraduate is my understanding, one graduate course, and his counselor throughout. Mm-hmm. And she didn't spot him.
Yeah.
She herself says that she was completely shocked mm-hmm. and was, quote, duped.
Yeah.
And I think this is a real wake-up call from the aspect of they can be among us, and even if this is what you do for a living and have done for decades, and this is your life's work. And she not only studied serial killers, she studied the serial killer that I think Brian Koberger studied yeah. and tried to emulate, Dennis Rader, a.k.a. BTK.
Yep.
So she of all people should be the most attuned. Tony, I think it just shows us that you can be walking amongst other people and no one ever knows really what's in a serial killer's mind.
That's really true. I mean, like you said, we've been studying this for all time. What makes people do this? But are we any closer to identifying them before they actually carry something out? And I wonder, as I look at this more and more, and especially as we kind of dig back the layers of Koberger, especially going back in time, and we will get to his teen years, and we'll get to the visual snow and all that. But I want to go back even a little bit further, because maybe that's where we should be looking more than we should be at necessarily right before they strike. I'm wondering if there should be more attuneness, and I don't have the answers to how you do this, but to children who are going through traumas, to seeing how certain children react to certain traumas, and what goes on in their world as they continue to move their path forward. I mean, as we understand here, Brian Koberger was a kid that always was a bit awkward, always just, I think, naturally, I'm going to say probably genetically, had difficulty relating to others, just the way that his brain worked, and went through a lot of hell, ended up losing 150 pounds. Apparently his personality changed very dramatically at that point in time. But nobody, you know, nobody could say you're going to be a serial killer someday. But we certainly saw a young man who was very disturbed. And we as a society, when we see that, a lot of times just back away. Hope he gets the help he needs. Maybe, hopefully, who knows? But I'm going to inch my way away from this person because they're icky. They make me uncomfortable. And that ends up putting them in isolation. Not that we should all become best friends with the people who are acting like they could potentially kill others, but there needs to be some attention here because there's a massive amount of young men in our country who we get to the incel area that I think you have a psychological problem going on there, but who feel isolated, who feel rejected, who feel not heard. And then we offer this land of them to just go and basically live that world, video games, this, that, and to really celebrate isolation. This culture of young men in our country right now doesn't feel like it's in a very healthy place.
Well, I concur with you. And, you know, from everything I've studied with psychiatry, psychology, criminology, all these years, they will say, the people who know, that by the age of about five, you've determined your personality. Mm-hmm. That is how young and that's how early everything is really developed. When you think of that, it is, I think, would be so interesting to really go back in a lot of these individuals' lives and find out from their parents and other people who were around them, what were they really going through during those earliest years? But I think the thing that's so interesting to me is you can take hundreds of thousands of individuals who are bullied, Tony, who are have very low self-worth, who are struggling to get around in this world and to make their way in a positive way. And so few, just a microscopic number become, or minuscule number, sorry, become serial killers, for heaven's sakes. So that's what I find very interesting is how many people perhaps have maybe even similar thoughts, but keep it so dark in the recesses and would never have the courage, if you want to call it that, the gall, the evilness that it would take to do something like this. And Brian Koberger, along with many others, right? They crossed that line. They crossed that barrier.
And the thing is with Koberger, yes, a very few. He is in the extreme minority of whoever crossed the line to be serial killers. But I would say you have a lot of young men who not necessarily become serial killers, but extremely unhealthy individuals who have extremely unhealthy relationships with other people, who go through a life of their own that is unhappy, but end up, if they do get into relationships with others, end up creating very toxic relationships, hurting other people, that those numbers probably are off the charts. We don't even know the numbers to that because we focus solely on the serial killing. But if we could get a little bit more ahead of this psychology in young men and this hatred that many seem to have for women and any sort of opposition to their own ego, their own male, and I hate the term male toxicity, but there's a lot of it when you're a young man, to beat that, to show them another way. But that's a societal change that would need to happen in order to have anything like that take in any sort of mass effect.
Yeah, you know, you bring up such great points. And when you look at many of these school shootings that are taking place right now, oh my gosh, you're seeing a manifestation of serious issues that are now happening, maybe not weekly, but it seems close to weekly that we're discussing a mass shooting in our country, whether it's, you know, in a place where people are gathered, whether it's in a school, whether it's in a church. It's happening more and more regularly, you know, as somebody who is a Second Amendment right, supporter. I've always argued and I've been able to show statistics to say, listen, you can't conflate somebody with having a school gun incident because a gun was found in their backpack, say, to somebody shooting up a school. And those numbers were getting all conflated. But now what I'm seeing, especially reporting on this, all the time, it's happening. It is real. And I think that's a manifestation of what you're saying there, where you have these young people who have no way to turn. They're not going to ever be famous. They're not going to be who they want to be. So they become infamous in this dark hole and they take others down with them. I did want to note too, Brian Koberger, from his actions, isn't a serial killer, but many of us believe he would have gone on to kill others, and that psychologically he's a serial killer. I'm in that camp. I've always been in that camp, but I just wanted to point out that, you know, the facts don't show us that it, and will never show us this, because he's going to be in prison.
True. I mean, I think the way that he falls into the line is because he killed multiple people in one sitting, typically when we think, obviously, of serial killer, we think of, you know, different places, different people, different times, but all in that one setting that added up to, obviously, four individuals who lost their lives. Let's talk a little bit about young people and fascinations with crime and weapons and extreme behavior. And now, there's always been that. There's always going to be that. And in a healthy, calculated setting, okay. I mean, if you're out there, and I always say, you know, I grew up in a hunting community in Wisconsin, so I get it. The kids would literally, you know, they'd go out of school for a week to go hunting sometimes. Generation right before me, they'd even be able to bring their guns to school to go hunting after they left to go off to deer camp. Obviously, we don't live in that world anymore. But what do you say about kids who start getting an unhealthy fascination with the darker end of things when it doesn't seem to be like a familial role of, hey, you know, dad, uncle, we go hunting. I have an interest in guns. More so, they don't hunt at all, and I'm really getting an interest in guns because I've been playing a lot of Grand Theft Auto or watching a lot of TikTok videos about this sort of stuff. And then when that interest gets really strong at a really young age, yeah, you could have one who's interested in law enforcement, or you could have someone who's really interested in carrying out really devastating attacks on people because they feel slighted or they feel unheard.
Yeah, it's, I think, such a difficult line,
yeah.
Right? It's a difficult line. Ramsland actually talked about it very recently, how most of the people who go through her classes, they are fascinated, some even fixated on true crime, on murders, on that psychology of it. But the grand majority become prosecutors or, you know, in law enforcement. They don't become mass murderers or serial killers, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the exact point you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I really think the only people that really know are the parents,
yeah,
the people that are around them all the time. And sadly, I think we live in a world that switched over maybe after our generation of parents, where, and I'm included in this, where you have parents that aren't at home, where you have both parents working to make ends meet, to try to provide a better life than they had for their kids. And then what you have are children that are completely starting at a very young age, unsupervised. If they are supervised, they're supervised by a babysitter. And the connection between the parents and the child has been lost in some mm-hmm. ways. I really believe this. You know, I'm in a huge social experiment myself with my family. My husband and I retired so that we could raise our youngest from the age of 6 on, walking mm-hmm. him to the school bus, doing everything with him, right? He's 17 now. And then our other kids, who we both had huge jobs working a gazillion hours, 80 hours a week, traveling out of town, and had to entrust, certainly other than when they were at school, their care to a professional au pair or nanny. Mm-hmm. And right now that professional au pair and nanny are doing pretty good because both of those kids are fine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But you have to make that connection when you're there. Mm-hmm. That means every second you're there, you're with that kid, so your child, so they know how much they love you. And I think so many parents aren't like that. You look yeah. back at, for instance, the shooters in Littleton, mm-hmm. Klebold and Harris. I mean, completely disassociated with their parents. You look at Brian Koberger, completely dissociated with his parents. All of these individuals seem dissociated with their parents. Bundy's mother, as I recall, was truly his sister. Mm-hmm. And he didn't find that out till later, right? His parents mm-hmm. were really his grandparents, as I recall. So there is this disassociation, it seems, from a very early age with the predominant numbers of these people with their parents. Dahmer's another great mm-hmm. example. I'm just touching on the ones that I've personally studied.
Yeah. And that's so true, because people, I mean, children, everyone wants to find some sort of acceptance, some sort of community, some sort of group that they belong to. It's what we do. And it seems when you have parents, I mean, and I'm not faulting it. I mean, I work my butt off. Luckily, I'm in my house, so I get to see my daughter all the time. But I'm always working. And there's tons of people who are always working because you got to make the ends meet. And I think sometimes, especially when you're out of the house, it can be hard to always be that person that's going to be there when they really need you, because you only have so much energy and so much time as well. And it's easy to sometimes miss some of those places and pieces where the kids are really reaching out, not necessarily in an obvious way, for acceptance, for love, for attention, for that reassurance that things will be okay, to keep them on a track. But unfortunately, when that's not in existence, we go to this. And then we get online, and I'm holding up a phone if you're listening to the podcast, or we go to the message board, or we go to whatever, social media. And obviously, Koberger did exactly that. He wasn't finding that sort of warmth with his family. And I'm not faulting his family, because I don't think anyone could have shown him the warmth that he needed. I don't think his brain was capable of receiving it. But he was looking for it. He thinks he knew that he wanted it. He knew he had it at one point in time. And eventually, he found it online. And as far as we know, it started out with that that message board, that community talking about Visual Snow and other people going, yeah, I can recognize it. I can hear you there. And then that kind of began this path of looking at things differently, or finding a place of his voice being accepted, being able to say, I treat my dad like crap, and I don't know why. I feel like people are in meat suits. And all the things that he wrote about, just dehumanizing basically everyone around him, I don't think it was necessarily because he wanted to be evil, but that's how his mind worked. That's how he saw people from a very, very young age, and nobody knew it until eventually we look back at message boards 10 years later. I mean, people need to get in front of this. Parents need to get in front of this. But I don't know how on earth we change any of that. You'll have to rewire parents or start teaching kids from a very young age, hey, when you get to be parents, you got to be looking out for this in your kids. I don't know how we get there.
Yeah. And you know why? I like your point you're bringing up about when you look at many of the other siblings that were siblings of mass murderers and, serial killers, they're all normal. Mm-hmm. I mean, from a standpoint of they're not, you know, going out and doing those types of crimes. So your point is well received. I think that's just how he was wired. I really believe the people that are this evil mm-hmm. and this psychotic, they are wired that way. So it doesn't matter if they had the perfect, you know, what in their eyes would have been the perfect world or not, mm-hmm. They would have likely ended up this way. That's how I believe. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about those in the gang life as an example.
Sure, that's a different world. You know, yeah.
It's a different world, but they end up doing the same sort of things. They mm-hmm. really become serial killers.
Yeah.
They kill all the time in all sorts of different instances. They don't care. They have no empathy for life. So they also become serial killers, but I think they are made. Mm-hmm. These guys who come from, you know, quote unquote, a normal, pretty normal background with no red flags, their siblings are doing great. The normal issues you have, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know his parents went through a couple bankruptcies. You know, his dad was, I think, worked not in the janitorial side, but in the mechanical side at mm-hmm. a school. But great middle class family from all accounts that didn't mistreat him in any way. And look at what happened. So I agree with you. It's deep rooted and nothing you can probably ever spy.
Well, and the thing is, what kind of resources exist for parents like this? And you have a kid, you got other kids, and everybody seems happy and healthy, and you're raising your son the same way. And I mean, that's just the assumption I'm making here. And he's just off, and there seems to be nothing you can do to fix or change this. Yes, there's psychologists. Yes, there's therapists. Very limited if you don't have a lot of money. And if you do, even then, still can be a bit limiting on what's out there in terms of of an overall overarching, this is how we're going to function as a whole, as a society, to help you get where you need to go. It's very kind of one-off. Okay, for this 1 hour a week, we're going to talk over here and hope this is going to fix everything. That seems to not work very well with some of these minds. And as a parent, you don't have a lot of resources or any sort of anything you can do if you have a kid that has these sort of issues other than, well, let's try and get them help. But quite often, you're just kind of got your hands tied and hope to God that the kid doesn't go do something horrible while under your watch.
Yeah, it's such a low percentage, as we've discussed. Yeah. People who commit these types of crimes, can it be spotted? I'm not really sure, because I think there's a lot of people who show dissociative and psychotic and narcissistic and
nothing's done with them, though. That's the thing. I mean, I think it's easy to be spotted. I don't think spotting is the problem. It's admitting there's a problem, I think, is the biggest problem in society. I could walk through a store today and probably go boom, 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 and probably have a pretty high batting average. But at the end of the day, when you go and talk to those folks, what percentage even recognize there's a problem? What percentage, if they do recognize a problem, have any sort of solution or direction to get a problem? And how many have just kind of given up and said, well, that's who I am? I think those are probably the three main responses you'll get, and a lot of hopelessness and helplessness out there in society until things get really bad. We only talk about the ones that go and kill a bunch of people. We don't talk about necessarily the ones who are making life a living hell for themselves and everyone else until people die or go off and get into other horrible things that are more so kind of one-offs and kind of not necessarily a direct factor of that sort of behavior, but more so an indirect factor of that behavior and the unhealthy way of living, which so many people are living in.
Yeah, no, you're right, Tony. But I guess what I'm saying is, of all those people, of the millions of people likely that have these issues that we're discussing, sure, almost none decide to, you know, shoot up a school, yeah, or become a serial killer. So that's the issue, right? In other words, they're living this horrible existence and the people around them are having to tolerate it or to put up with it. But because it never usually gets out of control from that standpoint of the physical violence, it's sort of ignored and then it just carries on.
It does. It's just, it carries on in different ways that cause trauma for the living in such high numbers. And that's where I feel like we don't, if we got more control of that group and that chunk of the population, we'd have less of them popping up and really popping out of that kettle of popcorn and going and doing horrible things. The rest of them stay in the bowl. Some of them pop out, but how can we get them so they don't have to, everyone doesn't have to be living in this life? I don't have the answers to it, but obviously we have a societal issue going on there. Let's talk about the some of the online presence. We talked about his early on, the writings, the Visual Snow, things of that nature, which, add that to a mind when you start trying to understand Visual Snow and what someone in their life is going through if they're suffering with this. I just saw the doc last night that you were in and Howard Bloom is in, the one on Peacock, the Idaho murders. And I thought they did a really interesting piece on Visual Snow, where just the hell that must be if it kind of comes on at a different point in life or it flares up and gets worse. I can't imagine trying to go through life and not be irritated and not be on edge with everything. If this is how you're always seeing things, then you have the issues with the ears ringing that can come into play. And then, hey, go be a productive member of society. He got pretty far academically in life for having those sort of ailments.
Yeah, he did. And it's not clear how long he suffered from it, but it was certainly when he was younger that he describes it. And, you know, Luigi Mangione also suffered from Visual Snow. And look at what he ended up doing.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm just wondering, that really, to me, needs to be, you know, studied more. And I think people who aren't our age or older that have seen the television when it snowed out. They showed it on that documentary, which I thought was good.
Yeah.
But most people these days, like, you know, young people, they have no idea what we're talking about. Remember, at least for me, I would stand there sometimes when we were watching and have to put my hand on the TV and my arm out to be a better antenna, like if it was something I really wanted to see and the snow was going in. Yeah, imagine living that kind of life. And I keep wondering how many other people that have turned to murder had visual snow. Did they even really understand it? I think sometimes if you live your life a certain way and every day you wake up and you're in snow, that becomes so normalized, probably.
It probably would. It probably would. But at the same point, I would imagine that would be debilitating to a certain extent. And I mean, gosh, I just couldn't imagine. I mean, it would be a form of torture. It would be like being locked in a cell and you're being played Britney Spears over and over, whatever it may be. But it's coming from your mind. And that's, I take the Britney Spears, I think, over the visual snow. Let's go back to another piece of the online, I guess, lore, if we could say. And I'm really curious to get your opinion now that we are sitting here and we do not know the answer to this. I don't know if we will know the answer to this. Papa Rogers, what do you think at the end of the day here? I mean, we got the image. We know he's the one who did it. The image of Papa Roger was the one that looks a lot like Koberger. Obviously, there's the Rogers reference to the incel. As we sit here now, and now that we know Koberger admitted to this, do you think he was the one online taunting the families and taunting everyone for a little while?
Well, I mean, if you look back, particularly at my Twitter feed, I think I probably did hundreds. If you look at all of them, responses and so on, I did so much research. I spent way too much time at that because, you know, you don't get paid for doing these online research projects, but you just kind of get fascinated by it. And I was fascinated by it. I always said the reason that to me it was like a wow moment just for me was studying these individuals and realizing the Dennis Raiders, right? Writing in, as you know, to KTV and to the different newspapers, the Wichita Eagle and Beacon. That was their format to be able to rub in the face of victims, to terrorize the society, and to taunt police. That's what they used, right? Mm-hmm. Typewriters, letters, all the different Zodiac Killer, many others that use that.
A floppy disk they didn't know was going to be traced back to him.
To his church, right.
To his church.
With BTK.
Yeah, exactly.
But my point was with Papa Roger, he's doing it real time. Mm-hmm. Like he is real time doing it on his keyboard. The minute he gets a thought, he's taunting. He's taunting police. He's saying he knows. And there were so many things, you know, the sheath was left behind. He absolutely wrote the script. Mm-hmm. If you followed him. You know, oh, by the way, don't look at the car. That's the wrong direction.
Yeah.
No need to look over here. The picture that looked almost exactly like Brian Koberger before Brian Koberger was ever named. I mean, I could go on and on about why. Let's just put it this way. There was probable cause to believe it was Brian Koberger.
Yeah.
Then beyond that, his writing style, that was something, though, that gave me pause. Different people have writing styles. So for me, when I'm doing Twitter, as an example, on social media, I'm not a punctuator because I'm just getting it out there and moving on. It's, you know, it's not formal writing. It's a wonderful way to just be able to kind of be yourself and throw stuff on paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Papa Roger was more formal, but there was some going back and forth. And what really bothered me was there were some posts that were put out after he was incarcerated. And there was a lot of online by the slews saying it was the exact same IP address.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me a lot of pause. So, Tony, if you're asking me, is there strong probable cause that it's Brian Koberger? I say 1,000%. If you're asking me what the Dateline believed and thought from their sources, Yes.
Yeah.
They said Papa Roger was him. Has Dateline been 1,000% right in all their source reporting? Yep, they sure have. Even to the point that they're, you know, the whoever leaked the information, there's a full-on investigation now to figure out who that was.
Are we going to find out? Do you think we will find out the answer to this question ultimately if it was him?
Yeah, I think we will. I think we're going to find out so many answers because, A, I think somebody's going to talk to him. I wish he would talk to the behavioral science unit agents at the FBI. Mm-hmm. That's who really, BAU, Behavioral Analysis Unit, actually, mm-hmm. they call it now.
Yep.
That's who he needs to talk to.
Yeah.
To me. That, you know, when you started off the show, you said, you know, do we need to study this, Jen? What do you think? And I pointed out that I'm not sure it does really any good at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But I do think it needs to be studied, but by the right people.
Sure.
It just galls me to think of people going in there, in a sense, and interviewing him for money mm-hmm. when I really look at it.
Yeah.
You know, and remember, there's no Son of Sam laws there in Idaho. So, you know, what parameters is this judge going to put on him that if money is made, that it goes to the victims? Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if the victims want this blood money.
Yeah.
I really don't. I mean, I don't think I would. I think I would give it to something in the name of my child.
Yeah.
But it's kind of gross to think, yeah, we're going to go to a nice restaurant tonight, kids. And, you know,
yeah.
It's commingled with blood money. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I completely hear you. And that's going to be a fascinating thing as this gets studied more and more. And there is going to be a lot of evidence coming out. It's interesting. Right after I get done talking with you, I'm talking with Howard Bloom and Robin Drake, the former head of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program with the FBI. So I'm all Koberger this morning on this with a lot of great folks. The evidence that we're going to see coming out, number one, in the hearing the other day, the change of plea hearing, we saw Bill Thompson stand up and kind of go down basically what we already knew, what had already come out about what they had against Koberger. We didn't really hear a whole lot that was new. Is there a reason for that? Is there going to be anything more? Are we going to find out more pieces of evidence here that we're being held onto that we're going to be coming to court? Or did he pretty much lay out the cards?
Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, there were a couple of nuggets that for me, I didn't hear Bill Thompson say before. One of the things that I thought was interesting is he kind of alluded to that. He said it was quiet, but something about they weren't all first degree murder. I think when he was talking particularly about Xana and Ethan, mm-hmm. I don't know if you caught that. It was really subtle. He goes, and we're willing to admit that, you know, that this one might not have been first degree, but nevertheless, I mean, he pled to first degree.
Yeah.
The question is really like in Massachusetts, first degree murder. In several states, first degree murder in Virginia is the one I'm thinking of right the minute you decide. Mm-hmm. So you can be convicted of first degree murder, Tony, because one minute you planned and executed the murder of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different in different states.
Sure.
I guess what my point is in all of that, you know, he pled to first degree murder. So I didn't look it up in Idaho, but at what point of computing that you were going to be committing this murder, can you be convicted of first degree murder? Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah.
It was just something that I found a little bit odd because I think all of us understand that Xana and Ethan, as an example, weren't his targets, but we also understand that Ethan was sound asleep, which they've pointed out over and over again, and was, you know, in a sense executed. That's first degree murder.
Yes. Yes.
So, but as far as, did you see them discuss the dissemination order and how the judge said that the dissemination order is going to be over? And then the prosecution said, whoa, wait, you know, there's a lot coming out. Let's not do anything with that till after sentencing mm-hmm. and the defense agreed on it. So I think everything that's redacted and everything that was ordered to be not, you know, in the papers, that is going to continue to not be disseminated. Let me give you an example. They remember the defense put up a motion saying, I believe four individuals were responsible for the killings, not Brian Koberger. Well, that has been censored and redacted out. So even when that goes public someday, I don't think we're going to see that. Can you imagine the hell of those four people? I mean, a sleuth gets a, you know, I shouldn't call them sleuths because sleuths are the good ones. But some of these social media people get a hold of a thought and they run with it and they make the lives hell for those individuals, you know, for their own purposes, I believe. But anyway, that stuff is going to stay redacted out, Tony. And I just pray that it's not so singular that people will be able to figure it out. But I think we're going to see a lot of this. It sounded to me like he's going to revoke the non-dissemination order. And I thought that meant it would include the dissemination under FOIA of these files.
There was something that Bill mentioned the other day of not having, and I'm not quoting this directly, I'm just going from my memory. There wasn't evidence of communication with Koberger and the home. I was surprised to hear that. Now, is he saying that there was no evidence of communication with the home that night other than going in? Or is he saying there's no evidence of Koberger having social with these girls? There's no evidence of him, you know, looking them up or having their images on his phone or having any sort of anything there. I mean, that to me was a little shocking. Like, how would that not exist? How would you even know to go to this house? How would you know about these girls if social media was not the driving source of your angst at these people?
Well, you know, as you know, you can see a lot on social media that is public, that people make public, right? And so certainly you can look up Kaylee, Maddie, Zanna. You can find a lot publicly even before this happened. But I'm going to say this, and this is on the IG stuff, the Instagram. One, according to CNN, and there was one other sourcing of this, and according to Mr. Gonzalez, there was on IG where he, I believe, followed them, Maddie and Kaylee, but they didn't follow him back.
Okay.
That's what I recall. And then I've seen a, I have the screenshot of this, by the way.
Okay.
That the day that I found out and the story broke, it was Brian Koberger. I will never forget this. The first thing I did, like I always do, is I'm like on Instagram and TikTok and, you know, all the social medias trying to see any links. That's the first thing I do. And I was in a position because I found out so early, right after it happened, I sent it out. And I saw what the IG, I screenshotted it. And then, and I still have it. I'm happy to send it to you, Tony.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
And this is what, this is between only Maddie and Kaylee that he was following them. And not that they were following him. Okay.
Under his name. And
under Brian, I think it's Brian underscore Koberger doctor.
Okay.
Or PhD, something like that.
Yeah.
And so I screenshot it. Anyway, everything ended up disappearing shortly after that. And then, you know, I'm always very apprehensive on any of this stuff because of IA, because of, you know, all the fraudsters that lure. I mean, this happened twice in the Reed case to people I know where they were falsely lured, to believe somebody was somebody else and that they weren't, right? On purpose. So people catfish constantly out there. So I never made a huge deal about it. I think I posted it maybe the day after he was arrested, though, on my Twitter, mm-hmm. or maybe 2 days later. I'm like, ooh, I see a connection here.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, did somebody put that up that quick? I mean, I posted on that maybe an hour or two after he was arrested.
It makes you wonder, because people are sitting there waiting and ready to do that. There's like a whole group that's
they are.
Like, let's talk about the motive here for a moment. I know you've spoken on that recently. I know you've been quoted in a lot of things and also in that doc. We had talked about the incel angle very early on in this. What's your thoughts on that? Is this someone who would qualify as being an incel, or at least very close to it? And were these targets more symbolic than they were of anything else, of an actual, you know, an aggression because he was slighted?
Well, you stated it well. That's exactly what I believe. And I've always believed that. I believed it before Brian Koberger was even arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Back on the 25th, I was involved in an article for Newsweek about who would do this. And I always said, this is an incel. This is an absolute femicide. This is a lashing out of likely years of being mm-hmm. tormented with the fact that you can't have the prize you think you deserve.
Yeah. And I mean, with that being said, with it being that, I mean, where do you get the signs on that, other than just his behavior that we've heard about? Do you think there was something else? Do you think there's another piece of this that we're not aware of? Because we know a lot of incels, they're in communities, they're online, they're in boards. And obviously, as far as we know right now, but again, there's that seal, he wasn't involved in that sort of stuff. But I don't necessarily know that you need to be in a community to have that way of thinking.
I agree with you. And Tony, I think for somebody like Brian Koberger, I think it would be embarrassing mm-hmm. to admit that. You know, CNN just did a documentary last night. It came out. It wasn't very well publicized, but they just did one on him. And they interviewed somebody I had never seen interviewed. I watched it. It's about 2 hours long, on one of his buddies. That was friends with him through middle school and early high school, as I recall. And he said that Brian Koberger was the type that couldn't get anybody, but that would always say he could get everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that'd be easy pickings for me, or things like that. He said words to that effect in the documentary from last night. And I thought that was very interesting. So it's sort of a compilation of all of that, right?
Yeah.
The we see him as being so confident,
mm-hmm.
Even when he's pulled over by the female police officer, how he commands that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure he really gets over on her, but he sure takes control, you know, of that, even that small window of a situation we saw over a woman. But really, when I look at it, look at the K-bar knife. It's a killing machine.
Yeah.
It's not meant for any other purpose than killing animals and or people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a military knife. It's a SWAT knife. It's a knife meant to kill.
Yeah.
And he chose that knife. And that, to me, was so premeditated on the importance of being able to completely mutilate whoever he was going after.
Yeah.
This wasn't going to just be, a pocket knife stab.
Yeah.
He was going to finish the business in a very brutal way. The other thing is, Tony, when you think about people who choose to stab, I mean, he could have chose to strangle,
mm-hmm.
could have used a gun, which, you know, isn't, those aren't personal. The strangulation would have been very personal. But to me, it's about wanting to get messy. Like, he wanted to feel, I'm sorry, this is so gross, but that blood on him, the power, the ownership of them. So that's why I say, for the people who are arguing, oh no, he just wanted to show he could prove he could commit the perfect crime. Nah, I think that would be if he decided to, you know, burglarize a bank and get away with it. The Lufthansa, bank robbery type situation. No, this was so personal. This is my belief.
Yeah, I mean, it was a crime of passion, no doubt. The brutality of it and that aspect of it is more and more disturbing as we learn more and more about just how brutal it was. It wasn't just I'm stabbing and then I'm moving on. It was dark. 6 a.m., the phone call. I want to talk about that. Him calling his parents the morning of the murders, literally just a few hours after and a few hours before he took that infamous picture of him in the shower with the thumbs up. We don't know what went on in those calls, but they weren't quick. They were on for a while. I can't imagine what that conversation was about for 40 some minutes with mom and dad at 6 a.m. in the morning. Are they talking about toast? Are they saying, hey, did you see there's a new toaster strudel out? It's mixed berry. It's quite delicious. The speculation, I know Howard Bloom's speculation is that maybe he said something to them and maybe he doesn't want to have them testify. I'm wondering what went on. What's your thoughts on what went on in that phone call?
I don't believe that. I respect everybody's opinions. Mm-hmm. Look, none of us know but Brian Koberger and the Kobergers. But judging from the Kobergers and what we've seen and judging from the fact that I just don't think he would have ever admitted it to anybody.
Yeah.
This was something that selfie just shows me the joy and, pride he had for accomplishing what he accomplished. It's like me yesterday, I got a birdie for the first time in about 30 years since I picked up golf again. Uh-huh. I had such brimming pride. I took a picture. I wanted the golf ball in it. I saved my card. I was pretty excited about that birdie. That's what that picture showed to me. And I think he's very personal about keeping it within him. I don't think he would ever want to tell his parents. I don't think he told his parents. Mm-hmm. Now, do I think he called up and had, was probably feeling top of the morn? Like, hey guys, doing great. I could see them talking about their upcoming plans for him coming there. I think it was a very cathartic moment for him, but not where he would have disclosed what he did. I really just don't think he did.
I have a hard time believing that the parents knew it for all that time, but I do wonder if there were clues in that phone call that were dropped that upon further review, upon the parents looking back and having the full context of everything, that they may have been called to testify and they would have found something in that phone call that would have led one to believe there's more to this that they may not have seen at that moment. And just the fact that then his parents would have to be there and be the ones that are putting another nail in the coffin would be difficult for them. But that also has to assume that Brian Koberger has some sort of empathy for his parents.
We don't have any knowledge, any information that he has any empathy for his parents.
That's the thing. No. That's why it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that he would be trying to spare them that moment in court of having to be the one that, again, like nails another nail into the coffin of their son. I don't think he can think that, but I don't think his brain goes there. That's unless maybe Ann Taylor said, hey, let's not make your parents testify against you because they're going to have to say this. They're going to have to say that. Let's just not do it. And maybe that was, a learned behavior of, maybe that would be a bad thing. Maybe I'll show them a little respect just because of a tit for tat. They raised me, so I'm not going to make them do that. I don't know.
I take it the opposite way.
Yeah.
He, by the witness list we were seeing disclosed and by everything that was coming out, he was backed in a corner thinking, oh my God, everybody is going to see all this terrible stuff about me, mm-hmm. this humiliating stuff. They're painting me as, not mentally being able to make these decisions. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To me, it's more of pride. It's like, no, nobody's going to, put baby in the corner. Nobody's going to say this about mm-hmm. me. We've exhausted every chance of winning here, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to be humiliated in open court on all of these fronts with all these people getting up here. So I don't think he did it for them.
Yeah.
I think he did it for him and to maintain maintain control of the dialogue.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.